I'd like to call this meeting of the Legislative and Rules Committee meeting to order. Can I have a roll call, please?
Leroy Brady?
Here.
Jason Foose?
Here.
Wheeling Greenslade?
Here.
Robert Stanley? Edward Marley?
Here.
Peter Lees?
Here.
Eugene Montgomery?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Approve, modify, and/or reject the October 16th, 2018 L&R Committee minutes. Do I have a motion?
I so move.
I'll second.
And a second. Any discussion, modifications? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Abstain.
Aye.
We have, the ayes have it with one abstention. Agenda item 5A, create a new statute allowing the board to retain jurisdiction over licenses that expire.
Okay, so this is here for the committee to discuss because of what we've been seeing happen with specifically home inspector registrants, but it would apply to all our registrants who have been investigated for potential violations of our Practice Act and then have had their cases voted to formal hearing, either because they refused to sign a consent agreement or because the board thought that the complaint was serious enough just to vote it directly to formal hearing. And specifically with regard to the home inspectors, their license is valid only for 1 year. So what we saw happen several months ago is that it's taken the AG's office a long time to get to a lot of our formal hearings. And if that year passes while these home inspectors are waiting to be prosecuted, their licenses expire and we lose jurisdiction over them. So, you know, they fall off and they have no incentive to renew because they know they're under a potential disciplinary action. So there are other state boards that have a statute which specifically says we retain, you know, the board would retain jurisdiction over a licensee who's pending formal hearing even if their license, their active license period expires. So we thought to bring it to you to discuss the issue, whether you think it's important enough. We have lost jurisdiction currently over 4 home inspectors, but it could be more like a rolling clock, to use an NCARB term, where the longer we wait for formal hearings, the greater the chances that we'll lose jurisdiction over those who have a 3-year license period, because we are bumping up on, there are some cases pending formal hearing from 2017 already, so here we are in 2019, and we may not be able to get them prosecuted before they expire. So so you know, operationally, I have approached the AG's office to say we need more help with prosecuting our formal hearings. What can you do? And it's slow as molasses over there. They understand the need, but I think, you know, we need to look at all our options and figure out, using the creative minds here, how maybe we can approach the matter to find a better solution.
Mr. Chairman? What are the consequences if we do lose jurisdiction?
Well,
say a case is pending,
right,
and we lose jurisdiction,
right?
What happens?
We if the licensee reapplies, we can say, oh well, we have this pending disciplinary action that was never resolved, and we can, you know, deny the application and make him or her resolve that matter, the previous matter.
Do we lose the ability to continue with the with the case against this gentleman or lady?
Well, no, we would, what would happen is we would, if somebody, it would effectively have the same impact as somebody losing their license permanently. If they ever try to come back, Melissa's absolutely right, the board would be able to consider that in determining whether or not to give a license. If they did give a license, any prior unresolved disciplinary case would be able to be brought. I mean, it would effectively be coming back under our jurisdiction. So it's really something that if somebody effectively gives up the profession forever, we would not have jurisdiction over them. Certainly we would. But if they try to come back, they wouldn't simply fall away forever. They would have to actually deal with it.
So the benefits of having the jurisdiction over an expiry, what would happen? I mean, what are the benefits?
Well, the benefit obviously is that we would still be able to take them to a formal hearing and, you know, concretely establish whether they violated the Practice Act, have an order that we could, you know, publish and maybe collect civil penalties and, you know, establish that public record so that when the public wants to look that licensee up to see if there's any, if they're in good standing or if there are any disciplinary actions, we have something concrete instead of just indicating on our website that, oh, be expired, you know. And, you know, just to throw a little more into the mix is there's pending legislation across the country now that, you know, Yelp is perfectly fine and acceptable as a way to determine whether a professional is qualified to do work. So there's, you know, that deregulation push, there's the, you know, make it easy to work push, and, you know, if we don't have the ability to issue a board order and publish that, then someone who's expired could just decide, well, we're going to move to a different state and there's really no disciplinary action against me. So maybe they qualify for licensure in another state, or maybe they don't need a license to hold themselves out and say, oh, I can, you know, perform a home inspection, or I'm a landscape architect, you know, without being registered. So
yeah, and, I mean, it sounds, I mean, what you're describing is like a get out of jail free card, okay, where all you need to do is to wait out the clock. And if your license were to expire as your case is proceeding through the system, you're not going to be held responsible for the outcome of the consent order if one is being drafted during this interim period.
Well, it, on a certain level, it almost has the impact of a voluntary revocation or a voluntary relinquishment. It's, but Melissa's absolutely right. The biggest difference would be on the website, if someone were to look a person up, whether it would show them as expired or as suspended or revoked or some other status, but at the same time, they still would not have an active status. So if somebody's looking them up, it would be to see what happened.
But my question, you know, making it more specific to, say, a professional engineer who seeks licensure in another state without a signed consent order or any overt disciplinary action, does he or she have to report that in the other state when they apply for licensure to practice?
That's going to depend on the licensing requirements of that state.
Right.
I don't know. That state may, it depends on the questions that they ask.
Yeah, I mean, our renewal asks, since your last renewal, have you been investigated or have you had disciplinary action imposed upon you? But other states may not ask that question, so.
Well, how would you answer it now in light of what you just, you would have to say yes.
Right,
yep.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And if you answer no and
they
find out you have, then obviously you lie on your application and that's a disciplinary action in itself, which can result in revocation or in denial of the application.
Oh, so regardless of whether or not the disciplinary action is completed, a complaint has been filed and therefore you are under the the requirement of reporting it as a disciplinary action in another state.
If that's what that jurisdiction
requires. If that requires.
Yeah, it certainly is an unemployment application. The semantic, well, not even semantic, it's the difference between have you ever been arrested and have you ever been convicted. Those are questions that are asked all the time. Some only ask, have you ever been convicted? But most now ask, have you ever been arrested? Have you ever been convicted?
Okay.
If I may, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So this enables us to keep a available history of this registry for the long term, is what you're saying.
Right, now, if we develop a statute that allows us.
Now should the, say for instance, we revoke a license, and I think there's like a 2-year waiting period, at least for home inspectors, where he can apply once again. Would the initial license number and the other number, would they be available under this person's name? Do you understand? Would an old history carry with a new history?
In theory, yes. If we can develop a database that could link the two, then yeah. And I understand that.
But if we keep jurisdiction over the licenses that expire, wouldn't his name show up twice?
It might. It might.
Yeah, I think that's going to be more of a database technology than,
But that's the intent, is it not? So that the history is available to the general public?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that information would be available to the general public. Mm-hmm. The format through which it would be accessible, I couldn't speak to, but
I understand.
It would be available. Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
So, what do you think? We currently have how many cases pending? I think we have 43 now. It went up. 39. Okay. So, yeah. I hate to see all of staff's hard work and board members' hard work too in reviewing the cases and trying to resolve them fairly and, you know, protect the public go for naught if we can't process these cases timely. So, like I said, we're working with the AG, we're trying to hire someone devoted just to do formal hearings, and Scott, you know, Scott can do formal hearings as well. It's just he's not 100% devoted to our agency, so we don't have his time as much as we would like. So, what else do you guys think? Anything else?
Well, I would just ask: have you? What is the AG's office said about this? Would they support a statute?
Oh, I don't know if they would support a statute. They usually don't get involved in like what agencies decide to pursue with their legislation, but I think in theory they would support it because...
Yeah, honestly, I can't take a position with regards to board enacting a statute or attempting to enact a statute. I can tell you that there are cases that have fed through indicating that in the future the courts may find that the boards should have jurisdiction over these licensees as they move through the system, but that there's not enough there at present for the AG's office to change its legal advice that there is no jurisdiction at present once the license expires. But there are cases going through that sort of indicated there may be a judicial shift in that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
It does seem to me that the board's a criticism of the board might, or some boards might be that they're ineffective, and that's been part of the, as I perceive it at least, the effort to do away with some boards is because they don't really protect the public. And to the extent that you can't identify past or pending or completed disciplinary action against a registrant, does seem to me to reduce the effectiveness of the board. So in that sense, it seems like this would be something that's would be desirable, is to have the board have the ability to do this going forward. So I think on that basis, I would support the idea of a statute.
And I would as well. I think I would echo what Mr. Greenslade said, that you know, our primary purpose is to protect the public health, safety, and welfare, and a part of that is adjudicating people who violate those tenets of the discipline, regardless of which one it is. And I can't imagine how frustrating it would be for a member of the public to suddenly find out that this person gets away with whatever wrong they've committed because they just canceled their registration, or they just don't renew it.
Or it expires. Yeah.
Or it expires, yeah. And then we don't have any access to them anymore. And
right. They
could have been significantly harmed by this person's actions, and now they've just walked away from it.
Right.
And I don't think that's fair to the public right. that we are here to protect.
And the information isn't available yeah. to the public that's why.
Yeah.
I agree with you, gentlemen. However, we do need to remember that the registrant is also a member of the general public. And should there be some type of limitation or statute of limitations on something like this? I mean, there even is on most major crimes, is there not?
Well, to speak to that, the statute of limitations the issue with this isn't really a statute of limitations one. The issue with this would be an issue of when jurisdiction would drop off over somebody for professional licensing. In a criminal situation, statute of limitations would be a little bit of a different issue having to do with whether or not it's fair to prosecute somebody under certain circumstances. If it's been too long of a period of time from discovering the crime, they would be able to prosecute and actually taking action. In this case, it would be more an issue of whether or not the jurisdiction simply has, or the board simply has jurisdiction over the individual. So in terms of the statute of limitations, when you're talking about home inspectors, you're talking about a one-year fall-off period. Somebody technically could inspect a home in September, have their license due for renewal in December, simply not renew, or lose jurisdiction over them by January. So it would not really, it's not really a fairness issue at that point of being able to confront somebody with prosecution, but rather somebody simply escaping their jurisdiction because of a limited time frame for renewal.
Okay, and setting the statute of limitations aside, because I do understand that, how long would the board carry this jurisdiction? 20 years, 30 years, 40 years?
It's tied to the case, so it just depends on how long it would take to adjudicate it.
So that's the intent, then, to finish the adjudication.
Right. And then if they want to cancel their registration after it's been adjudicated, then it's fine. And I think I'm really comfortable with that approach.
Mm-hmm. Now keeping in mind also that the statutes for home inspectors says that anyone at any time, anywhere, regardless of the relationship to the home inspection, can complain against a home inspector. So for instance, 5 years down the line from a home inspection being done, there could be a complaint against a home inspector.
It's the same for all the professionals.
So you would carry that, mm-hmm. it would then resurrect mm-hmm. in the event a complaint mm-hmm. came into mm-hmm. play.
Also, if the complaint came in, the board would have an obligation with the statutes to investigate it.
Understand.
5 years.
Right.
There may not be any evidence.
I agree with these gentlemen.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think, I think too, a little bit of board member bias, former board member bias, most of the cases that get referred to hearing usually are pretty serious in nature, and the penalties are pretty serious, and so if someone's going to have a reason to want to cancel, it's usually because they're in pretty serious trouble at that point. I don't recall too many cases being forwarded to formal hearing where it was we were offering a letter of reprimand and a $500 fine.
Right. True.
So that's kind of a little reality check on who would be inclined to want to take this route of canceling their registration.
Right. What would be the procedure?
Well, if you as a committee are interested in this idea, what I will do is research the other statutes that are around that have this idea incorporated and take a stab at drafting something for you to look at and discuss concretely at your next meeting. And then, you know, you can make suggestions, additions, reductions, whatever you want. And then we would send it to the board to propose pursuing a statute creation, you know, finding a sponsor and pursuing something with the legislature in a coming session.
Yeah, Melissa, this would be a narrowly tailored statute so that it only applies to registrants whose licenses have expired while undergoing administrative disciplinary action. Not a broad brush, that all licensees or registrants would still be monitored or tracked by, you know, my license may expire one day either by, you know, overt action or just, you know, letting it lapse. I don't expect the board, you know, to have any other legal, how should I say, there's no relationship between me and the board once my license expires or has lapsed. Other than that, as we mentioned earlier, if a complaint is taken against me by the public during the period I was licensed, I would be responsible for it.
Right.
Even if the board no longer has me licensed at the time the complaint is filed.
Right. As I recall from like the medical board and several other boards, what they do is the statutes talk about retaining jurisdiction, requiring the licensee who is under investigation to keep his license or her license in good standing, meaning renew it, until the disciplinary action is completed. So it would be more like that.
That's a little bit of a twist. So I would have to restate my license in Arizona after a complaint has been filed?
Yes, you need to maintain it in
good standing.
Now, if your license has been canceled, there's no requirement that I'm aware of saying you have to renew your license if you're under disciplinary investigation.
Right, and I believe there are different boards have different approaches to
right.
it. But Melissa hit, I think, kind of the most critical aspect, which is it's if you're under investigation.
Right.
I mean, this isn't something, you know, if your license expires tomorrow and there are no open complaints, okay, you're home free.
Right.
If somebody files a complaint and there's an investigation, then your license can't expire during throughout the period while you're under investigation or once disciplinary proceedings have initiated. You know, so it's determining a point at which you can't just escape by expiring. But we have to initiate it somehow.
Okay. But okay. Mr. Chairman, I don't want to drag this out. I'm
sorry.
Just for further clarification, since we are held to a professional standard long after our license has expired, if a formal complaint has been filed against us at that time, how do we proceed with the board? Is it assumed we reactivate or
no? If you're expired and 3 months later a building falls down and somebody
right.
goes after you, no, they can't go after your license at that point. And there are plenty of civil remedies, but at that point they wouldn't be going after a regulatory action.
Yeah. Thank you.
So the focus of this statute would be for currently licensed individuals who come under disciplinary investigation that then we would retain until such time that it's fully adjudicated, and then if,
right.
if they canceled, they canceled, and it's done. Is that,
and,
I mean,
and it may, again, different boards handle it in different ways, and Melissa's talked about the medical boards may require you to renew your license. I'm not sure, but I believe there is also an option that it just, the license could expire for practical purposes, but you would still retain jurisdiction in the event
yeah.
that you know, that a suspension is warranted, then it, the status goes from expired to suspended or to revoked or to, mm-hmm. but so that way you're not simply out there maintaining, paying to maintain a license or taking continuing
right.
ed to maintain it simply while you're under investigation. So you, you know, there are different ways approaching it.
I think the wording of the statute would be very interesting.
Right.
Okay.
Well, and procedurally what will happen is if the board decides to move this forward, it'll come back to us to review the legislation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we'd have a chance, another, we'd have a look at it at that point.
Right. Well, and I'm thinking you should have a look at it first before we
okay.
send it to the board.
It. Sure.
And
well, I'm just saying, no, if they decide to move forward with mm-hmm. drafting the legislation, then it gets drafted, then it comes here, and then it goes back to the board with our recommendation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll entertain a motion, but I think
sure.
we probably need one.
Prior to a motion, I just got one comment. This is Jason. Can we consider administratively waiving or paying the fees associated with the renewal during the time of investigation?
Waiving the fees?
Well, I mean, this person's under investigation, right? Are
right.
we going to sit here and hit them with a club and say, you owe us whatever amount of money? So we can continue to resolve this issue. I mean, if they're willing to cancel their license or let it go, and we're forcing them to keep their license, I think it's at least courteous that we waive their fee or pay their fee administratively, given that this is only going to happen once in a blue moon.
Well, if I can raise one legal objection to that, Jason, that could potentially encourage people who are under investigation and who are coming up for renewal to simply say, you know, I don't think I want the license anymore, and have the board pick up the fees, and then once the board's picked them up, say, yeah, you know, I do like this job, I'm going to keep it.
Okay.
So I think the intent of what we're talking about here, Jason, is that it would go inactive, or whatever the word is, during that time, it would expire. That's so they would have an expired license. We just, the whole purpose of this is we would retain, during the hearing process, we would retain jurisdiction over that person even though their license was expired. So we're not forcing a renewal. We're just saying we still have jurisdiction over that individual until such time their case is adjudicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. Thank you for that clarification. And that really, I support trying to find however we can retain that jurisdiction.
I'll make a motion.
Mr. Brady.
That the board or the staff draw up some proposed legislation to retain jurisdiction over licenses that could expire or do expire.
And
during the process of investigation.
And forward it to the full board for
and
consideration.
Forward it to the committee and to the board.
Great. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to move up to agenda item 5G. We have some folks here in the audience who want to address this.
Chairman, if I may
yes.
also, we actually did not do the open to the public.
Oh, we didn't?
The
oh,
public.
Oh, my goodness.
And just so how we reflected in the minutes.
I'm rusty. It's obvious I haven't sat in this chair in a little while. So my apologies. Let's go back to agenda item 3. My goodness. Pursuant to ARS 38431.01H, the committee members are not allowed to discuss or take action on matters raised during an open call to the public unless the matters are properly noticed for discussion and action. However, members may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that a matter be placed on a future agenda. Is there anyone here to address the board that is not addressing a specific agenda item? Seeing none, now we'll move on to agenda item 5G. My apologies, everyone. This is a question from the public. Does roofing design on non-new construction, i.e. re-roofing, fall under AZBTR as outlined in ARS 32-143? And we have some folks here to speak on this. You want to come up individually or all together? It looks like you're all with the same organization. You can come up and take a seat, and then as you do address the committee, if you could state your name for the record, please.
You want to start here?
My name is Jerry Brown. I'm sit on the board of directors for the Arizona Roofing Contractors Association and chair of the education committee. Our question has come because we had one state entity tell us that any design, no matter what it is, falls under the BTR. So the question came up is we're re-roofing buildings or restoring buildings or turning roofs into energy efficient roof systems. Does that fall under the BTR design? As you know, we've had a huge movement over the last decade to conform to energy efficiency, and roofs are one of the biggest things that can be done. And basically, we've taken an existing roof, like what's on this building right here, and put specific white coatings over the top of it and turned it into an energy efficient roof system. Our question comes at what point does a design under the BTR description apply to roofing? We believe it applies to roofing during new construction. So a building, an overall building is being constructed, and that roofing on that building would fall under that the BTR jurisdiction for a registrant, meaning an architect or an engineer is going to be doing the designing. But when it comes time to re-roof, basically out there, every roofing contractor will write up a scope of work, the design, and propose it to the owner, and the owner will agree to it or not agree to it, and then hire them to replace the roof. The same thing applies to all maintenance items on a building, such as air conditioning units, paint, whatever it might be. We don't believe that falls under the BTR, because it is a maintenance type item that has to be replaced or restored on a regular basis. And besides, there's just not enough architects in the state to handle all that work that's out there. So our basic question is, at what point does the BTR say, you know, that is not a design, that's a maintenance item to be taken care of by the contractor or whoever might be. Me personally, I'm a roofing consultant. That's all I do, is I design roofs. I design them for architects, and I design them for building owners. And then I oversee and make sure they're installed correctly, which falls back to making sure that whatever design is there is installed correctly. So our basic question is, where does the line get drawn for design versus taking care of maintenance items, replacing air conditioning units, or repainting a building, or re-roofing a building? So we're trying to get a definition and a judgment from you folks to tell us what it is, because we have to tell our roofers, if they've been doing this for the last 50 years, we got to tell them to stop.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
You're really concerned with the SFB. And projects that are government funded. Is that not true? Because you're not running into this problem when it comes to private owned buildings, are you?
We're not talking about a private home, or because a private home falls underneath the exemption.
Privately owned buildings.
Or any state owned building, or government owned building.
Okay.
Depends, anybody.
And when you're talking about re-roofing, you're not talking about structure, you're talking about roof coverings. Is that not true?
That is true.
Okay, so and your energy efficiency, you're talking elastomeric coatings, foam, elastomeric coatings, that type of upgrade in the energy efficiency?
That is correct.
Or reflective coatings?
That is correct. So
the question is, can you tear off a roof and put on a new roof? And the problem that you're running into is actually the SFB is telling you that you need to be a licensed architect, and they actually said in some of the paperwork, a licensed engineer and possibly even an architect certification. So that is the question, though, is it not?
That is
re-roofing on an existing structure.
Yes.
No structural changes.
No structural changes whatsoever.
Just to clarify.
Right. No, good clarification.
Could I just ask also a couple of questions, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
You talk about re-roofing. It has implications in that terminology. I'd like to just clarify it. Are you saying, is it a replacement in like kind?
Not necessarily a replacement in like kind, because some kinds of roofs are no longer made.
Okay, so it is a change. It is a design change. It's not a replacement in like kind. Does it meet the form, fit, and function of the original design?
Yes. And weight included.
I was going to get to that. The PSF on the roofing load. Are you altering, are you putting solar panels, piping systems, other kinds of energy efficient modifications on the superstructure of the roof as a dead load?
No.
Are you making any slope or drainage changes to the roofing?
That is, I'd have to say yes, because most of the roofs out there right now pond water, and per the Arizona Register of Contractors, you can't allow ponding water. So we do have to increase slope to stop ponding water, and that is done with lightweight insulation boards. So the answer would be yes, we are changing slopes quite often.
And you answered earlier, you're making no structural rafter or substructure, roofing substructure design changes.
None.
This is all top coating
changes.
To change those slopes and increase those crickets, how much weight are you adding to the roof? You say it's lightweight foam, but it seems to me that if you're changing slopes, you're also using lumber.
Also using what?
Lumber?
No.
None?
None.
So the slope changes are minor?
Yes, and you're asked for weight, what type of weight we're talking about? Less than one-third of a pound per square foot.
Okay. Will not all, your re-roofing will not substantively alter the design PSF value. Every roof has a design PSF value.
Correct.
And your modification in membranes or lightweight covering will not modify that up to less than a quarter of a pound per square foot or some nominal amount. I mean, I have to have some kind of a measure in my mind as to what it is. And also in response to the other gentleman's comment, you can't allow for additional collection of water ponding and crooks or crickets, mm-hmm, or any snow buildup or icing buildup as a result of your modification, because the roof is designed to a certain icing load or snow load or water load in addition to its, you know, its static deadweight PSF load.
That I believe the answer is yes, is what I'm hearing you ask. Understand that on many of the buildings, structural engineers almost always involved, comes in and checks the existing structure, determines what the weight of the new roofing system is, and then says yes or no whether it can be put on a roof. On a approximate number of 80 or 90% of the time, the new roof is coming in at a lesser weight than the existing roof because of the old roofs are literally, the old gravel built-up roofs and stuff like that, which are 600 per square or 6 pounds per square foot. We're coming back with a roof that weighs 1.5 pounds per square foot because of the new single-ply systems and stuff like that that we deal with. So very seldom, and just use an average number, most roofs are designed for about 6 pounds per square foot is an average. Most of our roofs come in under 2 pounds per square foot on today's market. We just don't add weight any longer. We stopped doing that a long time ago.
And I think I'm going to bifurcate this into two issues. I'm going to take on an issue with the SFB interpreting our statutes, and I have a concern with that.
What's SFB?
School facilities board.
Okay.
Actually, I think the individual that's quoted in here may not even be with the SFB anymore. They just went through a whole cycle of new people. But that being said, SFB, in spite of the fact that they were trying to quote our statutes to back up what they say, they can require whatever they want. So if they want a registrant of record to hire a roofing consultant under their purview to do the work, which my firm has done, we do a lot of SFB work and we hire roofing consultants, we hire mechanical engineers, I mean we hire a whole litany of consultants, we're in responsible charge of the entire project. And we do that for re-roofing projects. And what Mr. Brown is stating in terms of the technologies becoming lighter, he's correct. So SFB can, putting that aside, SFB can have a requirement that a registrant be in charge of that whole process. As I see it, you know, roofing replacement, it's not unlike painting an entire commercial building. Roofs do require recoating every 5 years or so. Doesn't usually happen. And, you know, there's nothing that stops a building owner from just going out and saying, boy, my roof's leaking so much, going out contacting a roofing contractor licensed by the, by the Board of Contractors to just hire them direct and come out, tear off the roof and put a new one on. No design, they just do it. There's nothing that stops a building owner from doing that. So I'm really concerned that if the board starts stepping in and trying to split the hairs of where is it maintenance versus where is it design, if they're going to put a whole new sloped, if it's a flat roof and they're going to put a whole new sloped metal roof on it, completely different ballgame. That's not maintenance, that's renovation, that's remodel. That requires a registrant, probably a structural and an architect. But for a simple, the state of Arizona quite honestly could go out and tomorrow, put out a bid package to say, re-roof this building. Well, I guess you guys are owned by a private, this is owned by a private developer. But they could do that. They could go out and get bids and put a new roof on this building. And I don't see it requiring a registrant. So,
Mr. Chairman, I think your problem really exists with the SFB's definition of design. I think they're saying that your roof coating, your roof covering rather than the structure is in their definition of design. I think you actually should be sitting in front of that board and talking to them rather than the BTR about what their definition of design actually is and having that board debate that issue.
We have.
And they stick to their guns.
But they fall back to the BTR.
I don't know why they fall back to the BTR. As the chairman said, they actually have their own jurisdiction.
They fall back to the BTR because in our law, it says on public works projects, mm-hmm. they shall be designed and constructed under the supervision of a registrant in the appropriate category. Mm-hmm. So they're extending that, thinking that roof replacement is design, that then it comes back under our our legislation.
But the debate should be about the word design, in reference to re-roofs, roof changeouts, tear-offs and replacements.
Well, even take it one step further than that, because we have multiple other trades that get involved. And I'll use the example that I've tried to discuss with the SFB. Since we're talking about SFBs, we're talking about schools, okay? If a school building, someone puts graffiti on the walls, they have to cover that graffiti up. If someone breaks a window, they got to replace the window. If someone damages the door, breaks into the building, they got to replace the door. If someone goes inside the building, damages all the carpeting, tears up the drywall, they got to come in and replace all that. Per their thinking, that is designed every single time. And we're trying to explain to them that we don't believe that's what the statute truly says. Now, I'll take it even one step farther, and I'll use myself as an example again. I have a state contract to design, oversee, and implement roofing to happen on the state buildings. So the state of Arizona uses me to literally go out and replace a roof on this thing under their contract. The SFB says no, that it is a design, therefore you can't do it. So therefore I became a registrant of BTR, so I wouldn't have to fight that battle on a constant basis. But at the same time, we have our whole industry to look at, meaning the construction industry, and this affects everybody. So this affects the painters, the door guys, the window guys, the drywall guys. It affects everybody. We're trying to get someone to make a decision about design. Where do you draw the line at design? Design, does it apply to maintenance type items on a building? And we don't believe that it does. So it's an Arizona revised statute, so we can't, you know, when we're teaching our classes in roofing and in design, which we teach, we can't tell someone to break the law. Just like we have code issues. You know, we constantly tell our roofers, you can't not follow code, period. And so this issue came up, and it has been an issue for about a year now, and we've been trying to resolve it. We've already gone through the SFB trying to resolve it, and they stuck hard and fast to the BTR rules. So we're just trying to get, you know, some kind of ruling from you guys to give us a direction so what we can start telling our industry. Either we can re-roof buildings or we can't re-roof buildings, and we can restore. And they have taken it to the point where if we're going to put a white coating, white elastomeric coating on top of a roof system, that is considered a design, and therefore we can't do it. I mean, that's how far it's gone. And we're saying that's not what it means. In our opinion, we just don't think that's what it means. So we're looking at you guys to tell us, is that what it means?
Gene. Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, this is a perennial battle. I mean, I even in my industry, the power industry, there's obviously constant maintenance. I mean, when in whatever power plant system you might have, or in your case, a structural roofing system, everything requires maintenance. And the degree of maintenance, of course, you know, can vary. But then, of course, as you mentioned, there's a threshold that's reached where you've now have gone over to a redesign or a modification. The kind of thought framework that we have felt comfortable with are the terminologies that I mentioned to you earlier about replacement in like kind, or meeting the form, fit, and function of the original design. If those intents are met, then it's a maintenance item. Then really, I mean, it's not something that warrants a professional engineer to basically have oversight. But I think it's up to the contract organization who's performing these to ascertain or to state that they're limiting themselves to a maintenance function, and they're not performing the design function. If they are, then I think we need further discussion. But so long as we can well define what not just design means, but what maintenance means. What does maintenance mean? I think maintenance has a little bit of boundary fuzziness so that you could have replacement in like kind or meet the form fit. It doesn't have to be identical,
right,
is where I'm going.
Mr. Chair, if I may, legally there is one area that the committee should consider in terms of options. The committee can't actually give an advisory opinion, nor can the board, because the board can only enforce in a given case.
Right.
For example, if somebody brought a complaint, the board could then look at the specifics of that case and decide whether there had been a violation. But that would be based on the collective judgment of the members of the board at that time,
right,
with their experience at that time. What the committee may be able to do would be to recommend to the board a statutory or a rule change that would provide a further definition that would encompass this type of situation. If you're discussing, for example, an issue in definition of maintenance or something, then certainly something could be put in the statute or in the rule that would provide for this type of situation. But the committee and the board really can't give a legal decision in advance, because the problem is a complaint could be made at a further date and the board could find, yeah, there has been a violation, even if you give an advisory opinion that it wouldn't be a violation, because that's going to be up to the interpretation of the board at the time.
Right.
So,
would there be a possibility of a substantive policy statement in which they can kind of interpret what they think?
Well, yes and no. Substantive policy statement, yes. The board could issue a substantive policy statement explaining how they're interpreting the statute. The problem is that's not binding on any other board, on any future board. So two board members change, and a subsequent board could simply revoke that substantive policy statement, or even when the policy is in place.
My hearing aids just set off.
Wow. Would a substantive policy statement be, would it be correct as a temporary statement?
Well, a substantive policy statement is designed to put people on notice of how the board is currently interpreting their own statutes. Again, it wouldn't provide any protection the public. It simply gives them guidance in how the board is looking at it. So if a complaint came in 3 days after a substantive policy statement, the board could still take a look at it and say, you know what, yeah, we were wrong with that policy statement. This actually does seem to violate our statutes and rules. So yes, it could give guidance, but it's not going to be binding on the board anyway. It's not going to determine the outcomes of the case.
In the interim, as we push the legislature for a statute or a new rule, push the board for a rule, a substantive policy statement might be an immediate relief?
Again, it could certainly give the public an indication of how the board is currently interpreting its statutes. I couldn't speak to how often the board has then turned around and decided something differently. So I can't really speak to that aspect of it. From a legal standpoint, certainly it would provide the public with guidance.
So I have a couple concerns. I have one that we are addressing a perceived problem that's been created by one government agency. That always is a little bit of a red flag to me, because it's like, oh, we have one government agency in the entire state of Arizona that is coming up with this. And they do have, and again, I will restate, they do have the right within their policies and procedures to say that they want to have a registered and responsible charge. The other thing I get concerned, the other concern I really have is whether it's a substantive policy statement or even a statute or something like that, we are running down a huge rabbit hole, because it starts with roofing, but there are so many other maintenance-related building materials in a building that it's how far do you go in trying to clarify this of what requires a registrant and what doesn't. does repainting a building require it? Does doing some stucco repairs require it?
Landscaping and irrigation.
They plant a tree. Do they have to have a landscape architect say the tree's okay? I mean, it's just, you can see how it could just suddenly balloon into something very, very onerous. And I'm always very cautious, you know, having spent the last 40 years in the design of buildings in the public realm where zoning codes get changed because one person did something bad in the eyes of another person one time and suddenly we can't do that anymore. I'm hesitant to say that this board should start getting into that kind of a thing where we have one agency that's having some causing some requirements and suddenly we're going to start writing statutes right. And all of that. I'm real concerned about that. I mean, Mr. Brown, I really understand what you're saying and like I said, we've used roofing consultants in my practice over the years, and so it's more about how do we address, or how does someone address, not we, but how does someone address the requirements of the SFB, and I don't see that being this group.
I have one more comment for
yes.
you, too. The Arizona Register of Contractors requires that when a contractor writes up a proposal or quote or design to perform work on a building, that they have to be clear and precise in the design so the average person can understand what they're paying for. That constitutes a design. So the Arizona Register of Contractors tells the contractors you have to create a clear design before you can perform the work on your proposal. So you see our catch-22, no matter which way we go, we got one agency telling us that we have to clearly design what we're going to do to the person's residence or the owner's building. And then we have the state statute that says you can't do it.
No. I mean, we're getting hung up again in terminology. I mean, a document can be a design specification, or a document could be a scope of work.
Yeah.
They're not the same. They're, one is just simply provided for contractual oversight purposes. One is a design specification, meaning, you know, citations of codes, standards, you know, calculations, drawings, whatever, to meet specific requirements. I wouldn't presume that the ROC would mandate a design specification in their regulations. They might demand a scope of work document for protection to the public, but I can't speak on behalf of them. I'm just trying to separate out in my mind the level of, again, the use of the term design versus other words.
Mm-hmm.
We just need to be careful how we throw the terminology around.
And I believe that the ROC and the SPDB are using the word design with two different meanings. The ROC is not requiring an architect for your designs per se for roof replacements. The SFB is. Is that not true?
That is true. So
they're using the same word with two different definitions.
Basically, yes.
I really feel this needs to be brought up with the SFB as opposed to the BTR.
So.
They need to clarify what's maintenance and what's actual design.
And again, we have approached them, we've discussed it, and they fall back to the BTR. They will not take a different stance on what the BTR says, period. This has been going on for a long time. I mean, we've been trying to do, that's why we finally came to you, because we got nowhere there with the SFB. So, I mean, at the very least, like you said, should they be dictating what you guys oversee?
Is it unheard of to confer with the SFB?
No, I mean this board has reached out to other to municipalities and such when they when particularly when they are issuing improper interpretations of our statutes.
Would it be wise to invite them to our next meeting and discuss it and put this on the next agenda?
We could certainly do that.
And see exactly what they're saying.
We want you to know we fully accept their rules. If they, in their, within their rules, say, hey, everything has to require an architect and an engineer, we understand that. There's no objection to that. We just can't get past the part where they're, you know, using you in which we think is an improper way.
You can invite to, I don't think we need to do a motion on this.
No.
We'll just invite them to our next L&R meeting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if we can
start a dialogue and see where it goes.
That's right. We do have our new architect board member who is on state.
Excellent.
Yeah.
We can invite.
Thank you, Rob.
So we need to invite him as well?
Her.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Sure we don't end up with a quorum that we want to take the bill.
Yeah. No, that's good. I like that idea.
Yeah. So we only have one sitting board member here today. So.
Jason.
And
does that
help? That's right, Jason. So we have two.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we, at just some point in time, we need to know what to tell our contractors.
Sure.
Because they're in limbo right now. Been doing for the last 50 years of violating the law, but in reality we don't think that's what the law meant.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Well, unless you don't have anything further, gentlemen, we'll put it on our next agenda, and we really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to agenda item H. We have someone here to speak on that, if you could come forward. Go ahead and have a seat, and you can state your name for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Jerry Plank. I am the owner and principal architect of Archicon Architecture and Interiors, and I'm here to discuss changes to ARS 32141, how firms are registered.
Okay.
It was adaptively changed in 2005. As everybody probably knows. I just settled a lawsuit a week ago. It took me 3 years and over $800,000 to settle based on what an engineer did on my team. We were hired to do a compounding pharmacy clean room. We were asked to use the firm DMS, which is in front of this board. It's going to be in front of the Board of Technical Registration, I believe, this month with a consent agreement. I don't know what it is. I didn't even know they were in front of the board until I talked to Jeff Hunt the other day. They had previously worked for this company and previously worked for us, but we used them very sporadically, probably hadn't used them in 2 or 3 years. And we were asked to bring the same team in to do this project. We were familiar with them. They broke off from another firm years ago. I broke off from another firm years ago, 30 years ago, and started my own firm, Precom. So we sent them our standard form of agreement 2.5 weeks before we started the project, and our form of standard agreement says that your firm is licensed in the state, that all the engineers are licensed in the state to perform, and they're all in good standing. We were sent a W-9 and a form of insurance for that company to start the project. Obviously, we started the project. After the project was designed, there was a problem with humidity control. We went into a whole series of meetings trying to fight that and figure out what the problem was. The client was threatening us, and the only person that showed up for DMS was Andreas Plunkett. We eventually got sued over that item, that it wouldn't hold its humidity and the clean room was going down. The day I was sued, I was also sued for fraud, which really caught me off guard. They sued myself, they sued my wife, they sued my partner, they sued his mother. They sued everybody on the planet. I immediately went and looked at my contract. My contract was signed by him. I looked at the paperwork he sent. The W-9 was in place. I went on the registration site. There was an engineer of record for mechanical, plumbing, and electrical registered with the firm. Okay? Looked at the form of insurance. Realized this Greg Larson guy, actually the form of insurance is actually another company. My controller got it. I went to find out that Greg Larson, who is the engineer of record who actually sealed the drawings, actually owns a complete another firm, Sequoia Engineering. But he's also the engineer of record on this firm. Okay? But he's actually owns Sequoia Engineering. So what we eventually found out was he wasn't a W-2 employee, he was a 1099 employee. That both engineers that did that job were not engineers that worked for that firm. They were 1099 employees that were hired specifically for that project. And that's the only project they worked on. After 8 months and about 30 depositions, we come to find out that Andreas used his seal illegally, had access to his seal, and sealed the drawings illegally without him looking at it. So all that did was take his insurance off the table and left me standing in the room by myself. Andreas was not an engineer. He wasn't an engineer at all. The engineer of record seal was illegally used and wasn't part of that firm. I'm standing there by myself getting my head handed to me. Now I have Doug Folk as my counsel on this. And he is, and I think everybody in this room probably knows who he is. He is probably the premier guy in town in defense of these kind of things. They, in the very first meeting, came back and said what he did was illegal. That he can't do that without having a permanent W-2 employee that is the engineer of record in his firm. So we went months, years, fighting this thing. That I eventually settled, was forced to settle because the insurance wanted to settle. And I'm the only guy standing in the room. What blows my mind about this entire thing is we have a firm that's out there advertising their mechanical, electrical, and plumbing firm without a single engineer on staff. Now, there is nothing in the ordinance of your old stuff that says whether they have to be a W-2 or a 1099 employee. Now, if I can't figure it out, how is my client supposed to figure that out? They sued me for fraud, but I fraudulently put a non-engineer in this mix to design their rooms. I had no idea. So I'm getting my freaking head handed to me because of this. And there's not a definition in Urals. But what kind of got me on this whole thing is I'm sorry, I gotta get my notes a little. I've been really bent out of shape. And you do understand, I've been practicing for 30-something years. I've only been in front of this board twice. Twice in the last year, of all things. You know, we as architects and engineers, we spend a tremendous amount of schooling time. For me, it was 6 years. And almost 4 years after that to get my registration. 10 years. I spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in school. I'm registered in over 30 states. I've been registered in the state of Arizona over 30 years. Own my company over 30 years. And I spend almost 80 hours a year in continuing education, keeping my licenses up in other states. And we're allowing this guy to own a firm in this state when he's not a registrant at all. Didn't go to school at all. Really? Is that what we're doing here? Is that the way we're protecting the public? Because how do I explain that to my clients? the way it reads, what gets me is we all understand that this board for years has been here slapping the architects and engineers who are non-registrants out there saying they're architects and engineers, practicing saying they're architects, offering architectural services, whatever it is. But think about how this works. This guy is an engineering firm. He's the 100% owner, came out in this lawsuit. 100% owner of the firm, who is a non-registrant. The other guys are following under your ordinance of 32.141, where it says, principal for the purpose is designated by the firm as having full authority or responsibility charged. He doesn't have to be an owner. Doesn't have to have any financial responsibility in the firm at all. Just has to be designated. It goes on before that and said the purpose of registration means the individual officer or the corporation of the corporation. But then it also gives another definition which allows him to be part of the firm and not own any of it. But yet, you go to your seal piece and it says, for a registrant to sign, stamp, or seal any document not prepared by him or his bona fide employee. So if he owns none of the firm, how is it his bona fide employee? It's the exact opposite. He's the employee of DMS because he's a 1099 guy. We have firms like this all over the state that get registrants like me in trouble because they are skirting the rule. And there's nothing that this board has that says that it has that the owner of the firm has to be a registrant. There's nothing in this that says that he has to own any of the firm. And it doesn't say that he has to be a W-2 or 1099 employee. There's nothing in the paperwork that makes that distinction. And so I'm here in front of the board today to ask them to consider a change to this rule. That you cannot own a firm in this state unless you're a licensed engineer or a licensed architect. Or at least a majority of the firm, 51%. Because how can he meet your criteria to seal of preparing it himself? Clearly, Mr. Larson didn't. Mr. Larson wasn't there. He never attended a single meeting. None of my guys even ever talked to him, anybody in my team, ever spoke to the gentleman. So how can he be reviewing and overseeing the production of this drawing when he's nowhere around? He's actually running another firm. That's what gets me. And how is the person preparing the drawings a bona fide employee if he doesn't own any of the firm? He's not meeting any of these rules. Now, it's my understanding that Andres Plunkett, who is not a registrant, is getting, has agreement in front of this board this month. But Larson gets off. Now, we all know what this is because what we found during all this discovery was a $250 receipt to Larson for this job. We all know what he was doing. He's a stamp whore. That's what we call it in our profession. Which is a guy who's trying to make extra money, who's a registrant, who's going to his designer buddies or somebody else who's practicing outside the thing and paying, and getting paid to put his steel on the drawing. I mean, his name is on the drawing. His firm is not on the drawings. It's DMS. He doesn't own the firm. He didn't even practice there. And it's such a small firm, and I got put in front of here because I talked to Jeff Hunt, and I knew this was coming up, and I actually talked to him last week because it just settled last week. And he goes, you've got to come here and talk to these guys. And so I'm here today because I don't think we're protecting the public doing this, allowing this to happen. Now, I'm registered in Nevada. Nevada does not allow any owners of the firm not being registrants. Period. End of story. And so we're going to allow non-registrants to be. You can't perform the work unless you're a registrant. So why are we allowing non-registrants to own firms and skirt the rules that we all spent years and tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars for the right to be called architects and engineers. And we go through a regulated body, you guys. We actually, in other states, have continuing education we have to maintain. We don't have a whole lot here. But I have to do more than almost 80 hours a year in continuing education. I spend tens of thousands of dollars a year in registrations in other states. Plus, I carry insurance. They left me standing in the room by myself. And I'm here today to ask for this board to consider a series of items. Yes, please.
I was just going to offer some background about firm registration in Arizona. I've been looking into it for different issues, but firm registration basically is just the old-fashioned registry idea, and it was created way back in like 1936 just to give the board a contact or information passage to find out who's working at a firm, where that firm is, and it's an annual registration that actually doesn't renew. It needs to be reinitiated every year.
You actually don't even send the form on it. It actually comes through the state legislature, because we missed it for a couple of years, and I got dinged on it on a lien that we couldn't lien because our firm wasn't registered. You all don't even collect the money.
Well, we do. It's a registry. Because firms and their composition change, and it happens often. So this is an old-fashioned form just for contact with firm individuals so that we know who's working where and how to reach them if we need to. This type of registration has evolved at other regulatory boards. For instance, the Department of Liquor Licensing and Control had an initial registry like this years and years and years ago, and now they require what this gentleman is referring to, which is divulging the ownership of the firm so that they can do background checks and for their own regulatory issues. But the health reg boards also have evolved from a basic registry into an ownership by a professional for many of the same reasons that Mr. Plank is here today expressing, because it is difficult to regulate in the modern era when these issues are presented. So now it may not be the case that you feel or that the board will feel that our professions are in need of this, and that's for you to discuss today.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, one observation that I have from my own past experience in these issues, I worked for a corporation that was a shareholder company. So the owners of the company were stock exchange shareholders, but we practiced engineering. And in our state, and this was in New York, we required that a responsible principal be in charge of the subsidiary. What we created was a wholly owned independent subsidiary within the corporation, which had the engineering functions associated with it. But the parties who were identified were not owners of the company. The company was a multi-billion dollar corporation, but no one was the owner of it.
Right.
But we were in responsible charge of that subsidiary. So we just have to be careful as to how we carve this language out. I mean, if you demand that all practice of engineering, all firms which practice engineering must have a principal who is a registrant and an owner of the firm, that might be burdensome. It would not be practical if it were a shareholder-owned corporation.
Well, how did you meet the rule that it was a bona fide employee?
Mr. Chairman?
Yep, Mr. Mayor. Let's let these guys in then.
Yeah, I mean, we were W-2. Well, everyone in the firm was a W-2 employee.
I am a little bit confused. I don't know what your position in this was.
I was the architect of record, and they worked under me.
Okay, so you were the architect of record. You did not stamp the drawings?
I did.
Okay, and didn't you say there was someone else who also stamped the drawings?
No, I said Mr. Larson stamped the drawings for the mechanical and plumbing side of this project.
Okay.
I stamped the drawings from the architectural side.
The architectural point, okay.
Yes.
Mr. Larson was a 1099
employee of the
contract
firm,
employee.
Not a W-2 employee of the firm. So he didn't work for the firm. And so my point behind that is, let's take that one step farther. Mm-hmm. So when, let's say that that was the only job he worked on, and then now Mr. Larson doesn't have any more work, and he's out recruiting work. He doesn't have a contract with that engineer. The engineer's not an employee anymore because he only did the one job. So Mr. Plunkett's card, he's out there saying, I own an engineering firm. When he really doesn't have an engineer that works for him at all. What is that any different than a guy going out who's a non-registrant saying that I offer architectural services and he's not an architect? The point is, I don't think he is. I think he's scamming us. I think he's scamming the public, and I think he's scamming the law, and I think he's scamming that he wants to be an engineer, but didn't really want to go through the effort to be an engineer. So he's trying to own an engineering firm without being an engineer, because he didn't want to go through the schooling, the licensure, and all the crap we have to go through to own that title, to have the honor of having that title.
Do you guys remember the roundabout case?
Yep. I was just, that was coming to mind.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
And that's a case where, and very similar to this, where the registrant wasn't actually registered in Arizona, was a California traffic engineer, which Arizona doesn't recognize. We require civil mm-hmm. registration, and he was designing roundabouts in Arizona, and we, as the board, reviewed the complaint and determined he needed to be registered. And he, instead of becoming registered, hired somebody who was registered to be the principal on the project.
Well, I think there's a big difference. We get asked by other architects who might be the architect for Hyatt to come in and take a Hyatt set of drawings that we have to now modify or change and make it fit a site, change the exterior. We might add a wing onto it. We might do all kinds of things. But we're getting drawings from another. So to me, that's peer-to-peer review stuff. That's peer-to-peer stuff. He's a registered architect who's sending me a set of drawings to look at and use parts of to what I'm doing. But having a non-registrant, that's the issue here,
okay.
In my opinion. It's the non-registrant to registrant issue that becomes the big rub to me. That, to me, Mr. Plunkett was scamming us. He actually, and it really didn't come out until I got issued a fraud complaint, and I actually sent him an email and said, WTF, what the heck is this? And he wrote me this long explanation that he was within the law, that they were 1099, that da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I'm telling you, Doug Folk and Chris Osak, who were mine, basically said, that is wrong, period. He is not a W-2 employee, so therefore, and I go back and look at anything, it makes no distinction in your stuff whether it's a 1099 or W-2. It doesn't say anything about it. Doesn't address it at all.
It doesn't, and it raises concerns for me, because I'm a firm believer that firms, or unattended, should be held by someone who is a registrant. And if you look at 32.141A, it's principal of a firm. Now, to me, maybe we need to refine the definition of principal. Maybe it's something as simple as that, because to me, I'm a principal in my firm because I own stock in my firm. I'm mm-hmm. a firm owner. That makes me a principal. I've got 7 other principals in my firm.
Just look at paragraph A.
That's what I'm talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm saying a principal of the firm. So we have to go back to what's the definition of principal?
That it says who is also a registrar.
Who is also a registrar, right. So now it's doing what I want it to do, yeah. but that's why I'm saying we need to go back and look at what is the definition of principal in our statutes.
Yeah, but that problem is that's not what we're enforcing.
It's
in there, I think, in parts.
wouldn't the definition go back to the statute, though. The definition has to stand alone.
Right. I mean, the statutes could be using the definition from 101, which is, yeah.
What's the definition in 101? I don't have a copy in front of me.
The principal is individual, is an officer of the corporation, or is designated by the firm. It's having full authority and responsible charge of the services offered by the firm.
It doesn't say registrant, but 141 does say it has to be a registrant. Right. So what I'm asking also Scott, you have to read them both right together.
Well, yes. Right, yeah, it would be a principal who's a registrant.
So you read the word principal, you go back to 101, principal says it's an owner of the firm in very...
I can mean the
distinct terms.
That's not the case.
And then you come over and, oh, who is also a registrant?
Four architecture firms that the owners of the firm are not registrants. That they have an architect that works for them and stamps their stuff, but he's not a registrant.
Well, I don't...
Go back to A.
Yeah,
no, I am confused.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with you, sir. I'm trying to get it. I have it in my head. And I think,
well,
to me, it's really clear. If we're interpreting it otherwise, I think there's a problem.
Yeah.
Well, and I think this becomes even more critical in today's age, where so many things are being done by private firms. For example, in ADOT, nearly $1 billion. Construction program, and probably 90% of it is done by private firms. Only 10% of it's done by registrants within the organization. I can tell you that a whole lot of those private firms, it's pretty loose who their employees are who are sealing the plans.
I apologize. Looks like Jason Fusa has fallen out. He may have been trying to contact us, that beeping might have been, okay. But I'm not sure. I'm going to give him a call back if that's okay. I apologize.
That's fine. We'll pause for a moment.
So do you think we need to make our rule or the statute more clear? Or?
Absolutely.
Oh, you want to?
Sorry.
I think at minimum you need to find two things.
This is Donna. How can I help you?
Can't they speak with Jason Foose?
They can either find an employee.
Hello?
Can't they speak with Jason Foose?
Okay, one moment. I'm sorry. The person you were calling.
Jason?
Yes, I was dropped at 9:57 for the record. I'm back online here.
Right. Thank you, Jason. Welcome back. All right, sir.
And I didn't want to interrupt Leroy when he was talking on the last call when I called in, so I should have said something.
Not if you're dropped.
Technology.
But when it comes to public works projects, a lot of those contracts, there's no differentiation on whether they're W-2 or 1099, and exactly what those principles are that are sealing those plans.
So it's going to get muddier. I just came back from the NCARB regional meeting, and part of our discussions were how is responsible charge, bona fide employee going to evolve in an international technology-driven market? So it's... I'm a little concerned because it's only going to get worse than what we're seeing now, where you've got international firms that somebody's here in Phoenix managing the project and their whole support team is in the UK doing the drawings. It's just kind of the realities. And we did not come away with any solutions, but we just identified that as something that the profession as a whole is going to have to address somehow.
You know, the interesting part is when you're in the large corporation, the professionalism is completely different. Where we're having the problem is in the case of mine, is the smaller guys who are skirting the rules.
Yeah.
You know, the large corporations, they have rules of how their engineers perform.
Yeah.
They're very, substantially higher level of professionalism and things they do.
True.
The problem we're having is all these guys who think that they can go out and start a company and make what an engineer makes when they really are just some designer came out of some tech school years ago. And he worked for a couple firms and thinks he can, he's now is a mechanical engineer.
Well, what we could do is, of course, pursue this, and staff can research some newer firm statutes around the state, mm-hmm. at least, to see how some of our other boards are handling the ownership issues, and maybe bring those back to you as a committee to review and see, you know, gee, do you like this? Do you want to recommend a possible rule or statute change or something to make the issue more clear, make ownership a requirement? You know, since we have it in statute, what I'm thinking is maybe we could just write a rule that talks about firm registration and ownership requirements, yeah. and bona fide employee and supervision and that sort of thing.
And we really need to clarify bona fide employee, because and part of something I've always struggled with, and I always take the most conservative approach on this, because there's been times when, you know, folks in my firm are going, hey, we could hire this guy on contract and do it this way, and I go, it doesn't work, because the IRS has a whole set of definitions of what constitutes a contract employee, and if they're working under your direct supervision, they don't meet the IRS definition, so they can't be a contract employee. At least this is my interpretation, and I prefer to err that way, because it's kept me out of jail or whatever.
Yeah, kept me from being in front of here.
Kept me from being in front of here as well. So I think we need to research it.
I'm registered in a lot of states, and so I would suggest not just looking at this state. I'm registered all over the place, anywhere on the West Coast, California, Colorado, Nevada. Two things that you brought up earlier that I can maybe point out. Their firm registrations are their way to track who is in charge and responsible mm-hmm. in the firm. It's not some antiquated thing. Every state that I am, I have to submit a firm registration. And who the architect is, what his registration number is, everything to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And I think we should look at other states on how they use that firm registration. It's not just some antiquated, it's a tracking device of who's responsible in the firm. And I think I agree with it that the state should have that, because they need to have a party they can talk to. They need to know where they're located. They need to know who the licensed professional is. You know, you can't have a firm the state doesn't know who that is, and why are you registering in the state?
We do have that. Every firm has to list a registrant who's in responsible charge.
Right.
But because I think, the two laws go together.
I think what might need to happen, though, is because of I'm seeing this word principal of the firm who is also a registrant, and then I go back to the definition of principal. When I renew in Oregon, I have to give them the breakdown of ownership in my firm. Mm-hmm. I am the sole registrant in the state of Oregon, but I have to show that I own 22% of the firm, Phil owns 34, and on down the line. And if you go to Nevada, which I'm not licensed there, but if you go to Nevada, 66% of the firm ownership has to be licensed in the state of Nevada. So three of us in my firm, because none of us now add up to 33% anymore, because we're
transitioning. Other states have started to tackle this issue. Mm-hmm. It directly relates to the professions we regulate.
Yes.
So I think it's worth some research and bring the language back and see, you know, if you as a committee really think that the rule, we need to create a rule or we need to fix what we have to make this more clear, to avoid issues like what Mr. Plank went through and you know, the roundabout case that the board looked at several years ago. I think it's just better public protection.
Yes, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Well, the problem is how could I go back to my client and explain? He goes, well, you brought Plunkett in the media and you posed him as an engineer. He wasn't an engineer at all. How do I explain that?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we feel your pain. It's just a matter of dealing. You know, we're constrained by the statutes and rules we currently have. So that's why it's good you came to the committee, because this is the committee where new ideas for fixes start.
That's why I'm here.
Great.
I think it's an ongoing problem in the state, mm-hmm. and I think all the professionals in the state, including myself, feel slighted. that a non-registrant can own, can do this kind of stuff. We went through great efforts to get our licenses, and we go to great efforts to keep our licenses active and clean.
Right. And I know I can say that the board members all understand and are professional in the way that you practice. They understand that. And it's frustrating for staff as well to hear complaints about people who are trying to skirt the rules and the statutes, and it can harm the public as well as the profession.
Well, like I said, is because that first one you showed me says Ed and Register, I can name, and I'm not going to do it here because I'm not going to call anybody out, but I can name five architecture firms and four or five engineering firms that are 100% owned by non-registrants.
Well, you can always file complaints, and we will look at that.
What I'd like to do is the board to come to some realization and some agreement of what that term means. Mm-hmm.
Well, that sounds like a good plan.
And then force all these firms to be compliant. If they're not compliant, then we can file complaints about them. But I think right now it's the one, frankly, after reading all this stuff and going through all this stuff, through this entire case, it was so muddy, it was like, I'm going to get caught regardless here. There's no way for me to get out of this. And then what they did is Plunkett came out and lied for Larson that I illegally used the stamp, which essentially released him from the case. Boom. Even though we have a receipt showing that he got paid to work on this project at some point. They released him from the case. So it took his insurance off the table.
Okay.
Brutal.
Yeah. So Mr. Farland's just said that we're investigating it. And
yes.
We're going to do our best to make sure we figure out what's going on.
I know you are, and I didn't even know because my lawyers told me you can't turn him in yet because you need him because he's already lied once, he's going to lie on your side and make it worse for you and blah, blah, blah. So I followed what they told me, and then I called, as soon as it settled, I called Jeff Hunt, who I knew. Jeff goes, oh, yeah, by the way, that case is already open. And it was turned in by the expert on the other side.
Well, so our process can work.
It can work.
You just have to bear with us.
I didn't know it, but...
Yes.
But my point is Jeff asked me to come here and explain the 1099 W-2 problem and this and express my concerns because I just got abused for 3 years over it.
Yep. We really appreciate your time.
We really do.
And you have raised a good issue, and we will...
Thank you. And if you need me back, if you need an outside guy to help you, I'm here.
Perfect.
I advocate for our profession. I think our profession... needs this, and I don't like what I see. I thought the advent of the tech schools bringing tech guys into our profession really hurt our profession years ago.
Well, we'll keep you informed when the next meeting of this committee occurs, and if you'd like, you can come back and hear what
if you want me here, I'll be here as much as you need to discuss it and tell you from a practicing side what concerns we have and what we're running into out there. That is actually hurting us.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it this morning.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you.
And if we can agendize this for the next one, do some research.
Yeah.
This case he's talking about going to the board. Is it going to a board or is it going to a committee?
It is under investigation, and so we'll be coming to the board for board action.
Okay. Directly to the board.
Is this the individual who received $250 for what he was implying was plan stamping?
Yeah, I don't think we can talk about it just yet.
We can't?
Still
we can't discuss this
act
in fact?
No.
Yeah.
We can't discuss an open case.
Right.
No.
Oh, no, I don't mean the case. I mean what we just went through.
It has to be on the agenda.
Well, this is on the agenda. I'm not talking about the case. I mean... Can we continue this discussion we had even though this gentleman left the room?
I'd rather not hear the discussion being a member of the board. I'd rather move on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the case
fair enough.
An issue will come before the board for action.
Right.
Is it going to an EAC committee first?
I think so.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Not necessarily because it involves a non-registrant practice per se issues.
All right.
Let's move on.
I know Mr. Groh is here.
Yes. So we're going to go to agenda item I. Mr. Grove, do you want to come forward? And if you could state your name for the record, please.
Kent Grove.
Good morning, sir. And the floor is yours if you want to open.
Let me just introduce him to you.
Yes.
Mr. Grove is the president or chairman?
President
of a surveying association in Arizona. He's been really supportive of legislation that the board has proposed and been involved in, you know, a lot of the deregulatory issues. He, I don't know what else I want to say.
That's fine.
Is that good?
That's fine.
It's United Surveyors of Arizona.
Okay.
And he's bringing his complaint.
I've never sat with Steve before. I'm not sure exactly what the procedure is, but...
Just relax and talk to us.
I don't have complaints as much as I have a question, I guess.
Sure.
And just like is written on the agenda, you know, as most of you know, you know, drones and UAVs, which are unmanned aerial vehicles, are being used for a plethora of different applications in today's world. And one of those applications has become very prominent at this point is a mapping application. So these operators of these drones and UAVs are creating 3D models of the Earth's surface based on the technology that they have. So by definition, those folks are land surveying. So, you know, my question is, one, do drone UAV companies have to be registered with the BTR? And two, if so, you know, it's my opinion they should have a registered professional land surveyor.
Okay. I guess I'll weigh in a little bit, but I think Mr. Foos will probably want to have even more to say. But my sense is, as I look at our surveying statutes, it is not they're not equipment or technology specific. So whether you go out with a handheld, I don't even know your equipment, you go out with a handheld GPS and you pick up points and you end up with a point cloud and you translate that into your software, whether it's done with a guy walking around on the ground or somebody flying something in the air, it seems to me if you're translating that and then you're providing that data to a civil engineer, an architect, whomever, and we were relying on that data to design topography for grading, paving and drainage plans or siting a building or whatever, you need an RLS involved in that process. That's my opinion. Mr. Foos, do you want to weigh in on this as well?
I sure do. I heard this line from the state of Florida, and their catchphrase is, "We don't make rules for tools." however, we do regulate the provision of services, professional services, and the way this item is agendized, these companies are generating topo mapping. So if that's done in a professional sense, certainly that falls under the definition. Where when I start to look at this, how do you regulate a drone company? You know, that's like regulating a measuring tape company, right? Rules for tools. But as we go deeper into this subject, do the minimum standards address anything with drone use or drone mapping or the things that we're doing in practice currently?
No, sir, I don't believe they do.
I'll ask the dumb question, why not?
Because the standards were written before drones were created.
So, Jason, you may not remember this, but the board, wasn't that long ago, it came up at one of the ANSI's meetings, and the board talked about it a bit, and at that time thought that because the standards addressed the service, that the standards were sufficient. Because, as you said, we're not regulating how the service is provided, the tools used, but the outcome. But perhaps it's time to go back and reevaluate that.
Well, we have a question in front of us that relates to professional services. I'm assuming that's what generating topo and mapping means in this statement. I wonder if we shouldn't go back and evaluate what the standards of care are for the use of drones, the minimum standards. Do we have any?
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to talk about it in the broader scope of not just surveying, but all the fields that we register. What is the impact of technology?
Yeah.
On what we're doing. Again, that was a big part of our discussion at the NCARB summit this past weekend, is we're not, our statutes and rules are not keeping up with technology.
Right. Yeah, sure. Do I understand it correctly, if you are a photogrammetry company, you have to have a registered surveyor on staff?
That's been the sports opinion in the past.
Okay. Well, I mean, I look at drones and UAVs.
Right.
And that exact same way.
Right,
so.
Right. So I think for now, what we have to do is investigate if we find that there isn't a licensee involved in, you know, whatever is required to do with the information drones and UAVs are, you know, I think we need to investigate that and see if there's disciplinary action for unlicensed individuals. But I also think it's probably time that we look at the Arizona Boundary Minimum Survey standards and maybe update them, maybe make them a rule. I mean, Jason and I talked about this briefly yesterday. It's not on this agenda, but I think it would be a topic for another meeting to talk about what we want to do with the standards. Do we want to revise them to address these technology challenges? This would be specifically related to surveying and would address Mr. Groh's question here, but we could make it a broader issue, you know, for all the professions.
Why would, why would drones and the other be treated differently than a transit and a stick?
It shouldn't be.
They're not.
Theory.
That's what I'm saying is it's not, right, the way I see it, it's not equipment, as
right.
Jason said, no rules for the tools.
No
it says
rules
right.
for the tools.
The tool you use, it's the output that
right.
is taken, and
right.
then somebody has to be responsible for that, those data that are output that I'm going to take from Kent and use
right.
to develop a site plan.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really simple because if you look at the definition of land surveying mm-hmm. in the state of Arizona, you know, what these folks are doing with the technology is, you know, without question considered land surveying.
It is. So
this
could be, this should
be a
registered this should be
involved,
complaint
in my opinion.
This should be complaint driven like everything
yeah.
else in the
right.
board.
Right.
I mean, all we need is someone to say, hey, this gentleman is using a drone to do land surveying, he's selling it to this builder or whoever, and a complaint filed against mm-hmm. him for not being a licensed NRRS. Mm-hmm. And that would put this to bed, in my opinion.
Right. I think the complaint is the unlicensed or unregistered practice of land surveying,
right.
not the tool.
Right, not
right.
the tool. What tool he used to do that
but I
is
think
irrelevant to me.
The board has addressed drone cases in the past, so maybe we could bring back some of that.
Mm-hmm.
Look at, see what they found then. What do you think?
Well, let me ask Kent a question before we go any farther. Kent, do you employ UAVs or drones in your practice?
Not in our Arizona office. Our folks out in California do.
Do you have any personal experience with them? I mean, have you used them in any other jurisdiction?
Minimal, no.
Okay.
I've had experience using the data that's generated from drones or UAVs, but I personally haven't been out there, you know, flying the drones to collect the data.
Okay. As far as that data goes, when you contract that work out, you would expect some kind of consistency or standard of care. Is that correct?
That's correct. I don't know that you know, actually exists. I mean, quite honestly, my opinion is drones are great for collecting, you know, aerial imagery, but when it comes to generating 3D models, it's not something that, you know, I don't trust the technology, to be honest with you.
Yeah, would you consider drones to be electronic devices?
Yes.
Been concerned there's a bill that has to do with this. I think I emailed you about that, I'll remind you of that.
So let me prod Mr. Leeds here for a minute and
he likes
and get him close to home. Peter, what would stop me from flying a little 6-inch drone all the way through a house and over a house and in and around a house and doing a home inspection?
The only thing that I would complain against you if you weren't a licensed home inspector. How you did the inspection, I wouldn't care about. If you ran a drone through a house, over and underneath the house, anything that you wanted to do, recorded everything and wrote the report to meet the standards, it wouldn't matter to me what you use. Although we don't have to be technically exhaustive, I think that would be quite technically exhaustive. But there's no rule to stop you from doing that. So it seems to me that it's not the equipment that you're using that's an issue here. It's actually the product that you're putting together, the result of your drone activity. And I don't see that we have to change the definition that's up here on the screen just to accommodate drones.
Mr. Lee, the use of a tool is certainly, and with technology advancing, there are many, many tools that are used, you know, even in engineering, very sophisticated, very powerful, from electron microscopes to all sorts of various failure analysis measures, non-destructive laboratories, what have you. The only thing we require for engineers to use the data generated by the tool is that there be records of calibration, records of testing, records of standards. So some national standard against which you've calibrated that tool has been met, and then I, as the engineering user of your data, can rely on that certification. So, you know, you don't have a 100% error band in whatever it is that the device is measuring. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how these UAVs or these drones are tested or calibrated or made to be relied upon by a land surveyor, but there must be some, you know, quality threshold that they would have to meet.
There is. And Mr. Foose, when you start using technical tools, many of them do need to be calibrated. If you're using a CO2 tester, you need to recalibrate the tester. Water meters need to be calibrated. All sorts of these little techniques that we use. So maybe drones would have to go through testing on a regular basis to be sure that they're accurate in their measurements. I wouldn't know. I don't know anything about drones. Personally, I wouldn't run one through a house. You're liable to get in trouble. But that's why we're hands-on. But I would have no problem with how the inspection was done. What tools were used, as long as the report met the standard and, of course, was accurate.
So that's where I get to. I know that I calibrate my tools, and I have a calibration process that I go through before I use them. And it's something that's repeatable and consistent and something that I can demonstrate that supports my series of measurements that I make. This question kind of leads us to that bigger question of where's the quality control measure? Where's the public protection with the use of these drones in standardized data or a standardized product? I mean, I'm not talking about somebody going out and taking pictures of somebody's yard and selling them pictures or anything like that. I'm talking about the actual professional deployment of these types of tools, and it just seems like we haven't had the opportunity to address any of that. So maybe that's a little bit different than a question of if somebody's a registrant or a non-registrant, but if they are a registrant and they're providing these services, where's the protection to the public?
Well, it would be when the complaint came in because they were inaccurate.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This question, as it's written in the agenda, says, do drone AV companies that are generating mapping have to be registered? That's a question about registration of the company. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've actually addressed that here.
Good point,
Mr.
Greenslade.
But I also, I also think the larger question that we seem to be talking about is who's responsible? Well, clearly there's the surveyor is responsible, and as far as the board is concerned, and if they produce a map and stamp it and seal it, then they're responsible for the accuracy of it, whether they used a drone, whether they used photographs, or whether they used something from their cell phone. I don't know. It doesn't matter to me. It's because the registrant's responsible.
So, and I think we just heard that from an architect about 10 minutes ago, didn't we? Similar scenario.
We did.
Where he relied on some other professional to provide services, and that didn't quite materialize the way that was anticipated.
Yeah. So,
and what difference does it make if it's stamped or not? If it's not stamped, it could be a non-registrant that owns a firm. So if it's that kind of work and it's being used, it should be sealed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess the answer...
I fall back to professional services. I think that's... I can't remember if it's rule or statute, but it's the first item in there that delineates what we do is professional services. So, I think that answers the question in itself.
So, yeah, they should be.
At least in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I just feel like they should be regulated just like photogrammetry is.
Yeah.
I think that is the conclusion the board came to when they talked about it before. That if it's a land survey, it's a land survey, regardless of how it's conducted. And it would need to be regulated.
That's well put, Patty. I think that's a good way to say it. And Kent, I don't want to sound argumentative with you. I respect everything you're saying. And again, you know, the deeper thought from this question is, how do we regulate it? How is it regulated? Or how is it standardized? What are the standards of care for a drone?
So. Aerial survey, Cooper Aerial Survey in Tucson, they do photogrammetry, they fly panels, they give you guys information. To me, it's not a whole lot different. It's a guy in an airplane versus somebody on the ground with, you know, I mean, it's just the technology's evolved to that point where what they used to fly in an airplane they can do from the ground now. To me, the same set of standards should apply.
Agreed.
I would agree.
Uh-huh. Cool. I agree.
And that will come to light when the first complaint comes in to the board.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything else?
Nope.
We're good.
Time.
Okay.
Yep. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kim.
So the answer to that question was yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We actually answered.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether they're a drone company.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, a true
do we need a break?
Yes, take a break. Break, please.
Okay.
Almost entirely.
All right. Back to the regular agenda order. Agenda item 5B, creating a new statute allowing the board to issue interim orders for chemical dependency and psychological competency to practice evaluations. Melissa, you want to give us some background on item 5B?
Thank you, because you knew I was chatting.
Gotcha.
Okay, so this is here for discussion, because based on my experience and Patty's dealing with issues like this at other regulatory boards, we are starting to see not just chemical dependency issues coming before the board as it relates and as they affect practice professionally, but also psychological issues and whether somebody is competent to continue practicing. Our Practice Act as it exists now does not provide for any oversight of these types of issues. So The thought is for your discussion about whether you think it would be worthwhile, given your experience on the board and having seen cases of folks who are chemically dependent and how it directly affects practice, like there was a home inspector case, major DUI, driving his business truck with home inspection ink on it and smashing into a police car, right? To individuals who are competent to practice because they've passed the national exams and have, you know, been a professional engineer or an architect, but are clearly suffering from mental illness. And we have no ability now to order them to provide us with psychological evaluations which would determine if they are competent to continue practicing, or if their chemical dependency issues require some kind of additional monitoring to protect the public. So how do you feel about that? I mean, I know we have discussed this previously, and the board had said, no, we're not in that business. We're here just to regulate professional practice. But we are seeing these issues more. So I just want you guys to discuss it and flesh out whether you think we should request or draft a statute giving us the authority to issue what's called an interim board order requiring individuals we suspect of suffering from these problems to provide the board with info, basically a professional medical report which would say they're safe to practice.
So first question right out of the chute is, how do we reconcile this with HIPAA and protected health information?
Yes.
I'm just going to go there.
I can answer that. I was the director of the chiropractic board for 17 years. I know how to handle and train staff on medical records and HIPAA and confidential information. I don't think by law we would be required to report our actions to the federal government, but I would have to look into that. Healthcare providers have to be reported.
And I'm not so much concerned with the reporting, but if something comes before this board in an open public venue, then we have issues of confidentiality.
Right.
And
we could address that by going into executive session to look at records that were considered confidential.
Okay.
And it might be something, if we do go the way of creating a statute like this, that we make confidentiality specific in the statute, saying that even after the investigation is concluded, this particular report is confidential,
redacted,
whatever, that sort of thing. We're just thinking in terms of giving the board relevant information to make the best decision to protect the public.
So, again, back.
I misread this entire thing. I thought it meant that we wanted to do drug testing on the guys who are doing our evaluation.
No.
I was going to say, we have enough trouble getting these guys in there as it is. So we put a comma after psychological competency to practice, put a comma after practice,
okay,
and then
I
we have evaluation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good thing I explained it, sort of.
Yes. Because I was going to say, this is a little bit of government overreach. You're talking about individual cases where you suspect. Is that what you're saying?
Yep.
Or where there's documentation.
Right. If there's evidence to support.
Well,
right.
So it would come up as a part of an enforcement case.
Correct.
See something.
During the course of an investigation, you may become aware.
Okay, and then and what you want to do is you want to actually ask this person to take these tests?
Yep, we would order it.
If you feel that he's flying through the room a little quicker. All right.
So something that differentiates a health reg board from an architect engineer reg board is health reg boards, they actually are licensed healthcare professionals. They are often trained in this kind of thing, so that if somebody is reported to them and they're in the midst of the investigation, they look at it and they go, wow, based on my medical education and training, I think this person warrants further evaluation. I'm very concerned that we have a bunch of architects and engineers sitting around going, this guy doesn't look quite right, but I have no education or training to actually render an opinion that says we should push this to further investigation.
Kind of
I'm playing that devil's advocate here. Right. I want to make sure we don't get ourselves in trouble.
It really wasn't the medical professionals on the board. It would be during that case of an investigation, staff may become aware that somebody is seriously mentally ill and isn't under treatment. They may become aware that a person has been arrested for a substance abuse-related crime, sure. And that's the point of time that the investigation may come to the board to require the person to be evaluated.
Okay. But the board is still making that decision, and then at that time you have some medically trained professionals who are saying, yeah, we agree with
right.
the staff stance on it. That's not the case with this rape board.
Well, here's the thing. We're not saying you determine whether the person is chemically dependent or
oh,
needs
no,
psychological
no, I'm not saying
help.
It's just
we
I'm,
would order them
playing,
to get that professional opinion.
I'm just playing really big devil's advocate.
Yeah, no,
Mr.
that's
Chairman.
Why it's here.
And then what would we do with the information?
Then we could, depending on the recommendation that these professionals provide, craft a consent agreement that would require reporting, maybe drug testing, maybe doctor evaluations periodically. An agreement that would help protect the public and the licensee who we would retain in practice unless the report says he's a danger or she's a danger, summarily suspend and revoke, that sort of thing. And interim orders for these types of evaluations would require the evaluator to make these recommendations, and based on their training and experience, they can say, you know, Jane Doe is not competent at this time to practice based on psychological issues, so recommend putting them on a 3-year probation with some amount of suspension that requires, you know, intensive psychotherapy, medications, will report to the board monthly on their safety, that sort of thing.
Whoever's doing the evaluation, how does the staff decide, you know, who that is? Is
right.
it just one? Is it more than one? I mean,
there are people who provide these services to the medical boards. What we would generally do at the medical boards is the person gets to make the choice. We can say we know that these people qualify. You can go find another professional, present their credentials to us. So if the people are out there, they're vetted, they're reliable, they've been used with other agencies. The individual being evaluated gets a choice. We're not just saying you're going to go to this person who's going to find what we want them to find. They have rights that they follow. I really never saw a single healthcare professional or substance abuse professional say revoke this person right away. Mm-hmm. Their job is to rehabilitate us as this board, is to remediate and rehabilitate.
We're thinking to use a possible interim order as just another tool to help gather relevant information to help the board make the right decisions for the licensee as well as the public.
What would actually push us to do that? Well, other than running into a cop car with it. Well, let me call an inspection.
We've had the cases where it would have been useful to have that.
Yeah.
Well, let me give you an example. I mean, because there are times on the agenda with the board that staff is asking us for recommendation on an applicant who has a rather spotty history,
mm-hmm.
okay? And his history has multiple DUIs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Or drugs.
Right.
And staff is saying, we're not making the call. You tell us, do you want to give this guy or gal a license? They passed the test, they got all the experience, here's their application. But they have this checkered background. And you're right, I mean, how am I? I mean, so we once had a gentleman at the meeting and we just asked him, are you okay? I mean, that's how silly it I mean, that's the extent to which it'll come down to us. I really don't know what else to, you know, to judge an answer on, but staff won't make the call. They bring it to the board to make the call, and we're not medically trained or we don't have the background to determine whether or not that individual, you know, is, you know, has been, you know, how should I say it, you know, is clean and has a, you know, and would be safe to the public to practice going forward.
Understandable. What's the cost of such an evaluation?
You know, I have forgotten over time, but I guess I can express this to you coming from the healthcare side and coming here, how disappointing and frustrating it is to me that the only thing we can do with a person who is very ill, mentally ill, is revoke them or deny them a license. With this tool, you can actually reach out and help them. It would give us the authority to say, we think that you have some mental health problems, we need to go to this evaluation. Right now, we can't even say what the problem is. To me, it's heartbreaking to just say, I know there's something wrong with you and I can't help you.
Well, there's one thing, and that is, as an employer, and you see this going on with an employee, you can tell that employee that they have to deal with it. But we're dealing with professionals that may not, or they may have an employer that doesn't want to push them in that direction, and yet they're providing services to the public that could be problematic.
Yeah, as an employer-employee, because I've been in that situation myself, we used to have employer programs called Fitness for Duty. We actually were trained as managers of staff to be observant for aberrant behaviors. But even still, even with just observation of aberrant behaviors, we could only refer them to a medical officer.
That's right.
That's all I could do.
And go down and see
the medical officer, and they will, you know, do an assessment.
And that's what you're asking for, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
As we move, I mean, right now we're in an epidemic of major drug problems, and states, including New Mexico, has just announced the possibility of going to recreational marijuana. We're moving in a period of that kind of stuff, and yet we have no tools to deal with it from a professional standpoint and a registration standpoint, even though our obligation is for the protection of health, public health, safety, and welfare.
Mr. Devil's Advocate. I mean, it's not something any of our sister states who regulate our same professions are talking about.
So I am not opposed to this. I want to make that really clear.
Okay.
I just want to make sure, and I know Scott will protect us from ourselves, but I just want to make sure that what we put in place, I do so much mental health care work. So I really understand it. And one concern I have is, what if we're wrong? We refer somebody, they go through this process, and
you end up with a record, yes?
There's a stigma attached to that, and it's in your health record that you had to go through this evaluation because somebody thought you weren't doing things quite right or weren't acting.
Well, I don't know if it would be in your health record if a reg board orders you to do it.
Know.
You don't go to your primary care.
No, I know. I understand that. I just don't. I don't know how all the records are these days. I mean, with the proliferation of data on everybody out there, so I had this fear of, what if we're wrong? There's this stigma attached with mental health care.
Now, an order like that, if it came from the board, would be on record with the board.
Yeah.
It?
So it's on record with the board. There are probably ways to protect that. I mean, we redact Social Security numbers, we redact birth dates, we redact a lot of information from someone's public file because it's protected information. But I want to make you aware, and I don't know, Patty, if this came up in any in your breakout session or not, but there is starting to be this trend, and it's tied to the whole deregulation movement of basically, you know, second chance laws where you have a record, it doesn't matter what you did, but we have to grant you a license anyway, and with some exceptions, obviously. But I mean, it's just so. I think we want to look at it. If we're going to write a statute, we have to be careful that, you know, we've got this trend coming in over this way, and we're actually trying to make it appear a little more restrictive, even though we really are protecting the public health.
Right.
But not every legislative body is going to see it that way.
this really kind of goes in line with the second chance laws. Because
it does,
because
we're offering, but we have to write it that
exactly,
way.
Exactly. So again, I mean, we don't have any language for you to look at yet,
right.
But we can certainly put that together and, you know, let you look at it, obviously comment.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to make a decision today,
yeah.
But...
Well,
you know.
I think it's worth looking further into myself.
Okay.
I do too.
It's just going to be with great caution and very deliberateness in terms of how we proceed so that
sure.
We protect ourselves, we protect the public, and we protect our registrants.
Yeah.
The chemical dependency and psychological competency of a registrant will also affect his disciplinary action. I mean, if we
mm-hmm.
send him back to school, it may not work. We send him back to, you know, we send him out for peer review, it may not work. If the gentleman has got a real serious issue.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in reading what you guys come up with.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and here's the thing, too. If we
so long as it's not my evaluators.
No. Say we do get the interim order authority, and we do issue an interim order to a licensee, and they fail to comply. They don't go for the evaluation. Then we can say you failed to comply with a board order and take disciplinary action
right.
on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So again, it's just in thinking about the tools in our toolbox, to
right.
quote Jason, you know, sort of. I think it's something we need to consider going forward with our mission of protecting.
I think it's responsive to the trends in society
yeah.
today
mm-hmm.
that we wouldn't have anticipated. Even 5 years ago.
Right.
You actually have done something along these lines. We did have a complaint in which a person disclosed that he had a mental illness, and we worked with that person and his attorney for him to agree to get back under the care of a psychiatrist, remain under the care of a psychiatrist, and I believe he was successful and was probably off probation at this point.
Yeah, it's much better to help them rather than
right.
shut them out.
Right.
No,
and I think that's how we would approach it with the legislature, you know, is to say we're seeing this as trends in society. We want to
mm-hmm.
be proactive to protect the public and also help our licensees so that they can remain professionally registered.
So Melissa, we could basically put this request in a consent order?
We would issue an order if we get the statutory authority.
Just issue a
standalone
order
that says you will go for a psychological evaluation or chemical dependency evaluation, whatever we think, by such and such date, and provide that report from the evaluator to the board. And
okay.
then if they fail to comply...
Now, if this morphed into every... complaint coming to the board, having to go under, getting issued an order, I would be totally against it.
Yeah,
that's what we call government overreach.
Right.
But if we can set the standard, and we can set the minimum bar, or we can set the maximum bar, or whatever it has to be to actually identify these people, then I would be for it.
Yeah, I can only think of 4 cases in the 5 years that have been there.
Yeah, I just hate to see it morph into the very first thing you got to do. You've got to meet the board on Tuesday. You got to go see the head shrink on Monday.
Yeah.
You know, I'd hate to see that happen.
Right. No.
Well, I just want to say that I don't want to obstruct the opportunity to hear the question or see what we come up with, but my initial thought is this is far overreaching and far outside the scope of technical registration. If we're dealing with several over a decade, you know, there's other avenues to deal with this, and there's a whole branch of professionals that deal with behavioral health and substance abuse and all that. I mean, I didn't sign up for that, so that's just my initial thoughts. But I don't want to obstruct the opportunity to hear the questions and information that would support the side of merit towards this idea.
Discussion. Yep, I'm on the
good. Okay.
So don't know that we need a motion. If you guys just want to go back and start kind of pulling the data together.
Move it to the next agenda, I guess.
Yeah. We have a lot on our next agenda.
Yep.
Any further discussion on this item? Otherwise, we will move on to item C.
Okay. So B and C are sort of related in that we currently, when we revoke somebody for various reasons, they can turn right around and reapply for a new license effectively the same day.
And they have.
And they have. Yeah. And we're currently dealing with that issue.
Oh, really?
And so the question we're posing is whether we should put some kind of a time frame on how long before you can reapply once your license has been
revoked. Rule
removed.
Or law?
I'm not sure. I think...
I believe the statute. I know of one board that has it in statute, and it's a five-year requirement. If you're revoked, you can't even reapply for 5 years. So it's, but I believe legally it would be a statute, not a rule.
Yeah.
So
and
excuse me, I misspoke earlier with saying that home inspectors had to wait 2 years.
I don't think home inspectors have to wait. Either.
They don't have to wait, so they can jump right back in after...
Right.
After 2 years, if they haven't been practicing, they have to take the exam again.
I understand that.
So that might be what's...
Okay. Right. For our other registrants, it's 5 years you have to take the exam again.
Correct. Right. So this obviously is not going to be a popular idea at the legislature because we're keeping people from practicing. However...
the registrar is supposed to be protecting the general public as well,
right?
Right,
exactly.
Now, this is a revocation for a specific reason,
right.
I'm sure, right?
Right. And once you revoke and somebody reapplies, it's still their burden to demonstrate to the board that they're capable and qualified to practice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so we have denied one person in particular that we had revoked to reapply basically the next month,
mm-hmm.
by saying you haven't remediated any of the issues that caused the revocation last month to occur, and so we're denying you because you have failed to provide, you know, that you're capable and qualified. And so then a year went by and he's reapplied again.
Well,
so
isn't the revocation alone reason to deny?
No.
The revocation alone isn't the statutes and rules specifically provide for evidence of rehabilitation or coming back from that. The revocation itself, and I don't think the legislature would want a revocation itself to be a hard stop permanently on a career.
All right, but now for instance, if someone was coming from another state and they were revoked,
so the board would consider that.
You would consider that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It could be reason to deny it. It could be reason to deny at that point, could it not?
The board could consider the revocation. They could consider the basis for the revocation and how it did impact practice in Arizona. I couldn't speak to all of what the board could use it to consider, but the board could absolutely take that into factoring in their decision.
So in that case, then if someone was revoked here, shouldn't that application actually, well, they all go to the board, don't they? Yeah, okay, I apologize.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
First, let the record show that Mr. Brady left the meeting at 11:11. Okay, sorry.
I guess I'm, my thought is that this is, you don't gain much by passing this, and the downside is greater than the benefit.
And that may be.
And I just don't see that it's worth going through this and possibly raising issues with the legislature for something that's more of an inconvenience than anything else, if for lack of a better term. And how many times does this happen? I mean, how often does this happen? Not very many times.
True.
Yeah. I just think it's best tabled indefinitely.
That's a staff question. Could the language just be put into an order that when someone's revoked, they are not allowed to?
Just asking about that.
In a consent agreement,
parties could agree to pretty much well, to most things, as long as something isn't illegal, I would, were the board going to do that legally, I would probably advise a relatively low period of time for that. I would not apply it for 20 years or something. I would probably keep it a fairly reasonable period of time. I would be, if I were drafting that agreement, I would probably be inclined more to have specific criteria to be met prior to reapplication, such as prior to reapplication, the party would have these three evidences of rehabilitation or some specific metrics that would be able to be measured by the board. But just having a flat period of time prior to coming back for vacation, if the board doesn't have it by statute, I would probably be cautious about just having that as the primary, you know, you're out
yeah,
for 5 years.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, just the fact that you expect that you the time has expired doesn't mean anything, mm-hmm. right? I mean, if they got revoked for some reason, and they clearly did, because it wouldn't revoke unless there was a reason. Mm-hmm. So unless something was done to suggest that the person was taking traditional training or doing something to overcome the deficiency that caused the thing to be revoked in the first place, just the passage of time doesn't mean anything.
I'm more inclined to that too. I think it's not about time. It's more about did you resolve the issues
right.
that led up to mm-hmm. your revocation, mm-hmm. and that could take 2 months, that could take 6 months, it could take 20 years.
Sure.
And so,
how about the combination of both? You meet such a you prove it to us these three things have been taken care of and reapply in 2 years.
Well, I think at that point, from a legal standpoint, you'd be talking more about a suspension than a revocation.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think I tend to agree that I think it's let's leave it as is. It gives the board more discretion, I think, and it isn't about the passage of time. It's really about fixing what you did wrong. And if you're willing to come in the day after you were revoked and apply, that's pretty gutsy in my opinion.
Well, but Mr. Chairman, in that case, the board took exactly the action that you were discussing. We didn't discuss that, oh, it's only one day after you've been... that was not mentioned
right.
as a relevant argument. What was mentioned was you haven't done anything
right.
that resolved or showed
exactly.
remediation for the past sins
Excellent.
That caused you to be
yeah.
revoked.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
when you go for one of these psychological competencies.
The two were connected. I like that. Okay, well, thank
All
you
right.
for that discussion.
Thank you, gentlemen. Item D, should the board require professionals to write their registration expiration date when applying their seal? The board changed this rule in August 2018 to its current form where we don't require the date.
Yep.
I want backstory on this because I'm the one that pushed to get rid of it.
I know. Well, the new rules went into effect in August of 2018, and almost immediately after that, we started getting questions from cities and towns, which still require licensees to put expiration dates, even though our rule changed. And so I explained probably to three or four different people from different cities that they can require what they want.
Yeah.
That our rule changed, but that doesn't mean that they can't say, okay, put your date on there. And it, for whatever reason, is just confusing them.
And
so.
What I don't understand about that is part of the reason I pushed for it is because cities and towns were getting all confused because I would submit a set of drawings, and while it was in the review, the expiration date would expire, and they go, these drawings are expired. And it's like, no, these drawings did not expire. Drawings don't expire. My license might. But the drawing I sealed didn't expire. So I was trying to explain to municipalities why my drawings were still, you know, it wasn't like a carton of milk.
Right. Well, and when you submitted it, your license was valid.
It was current,
so
yeah.
they can just check on the website, which Kurt fixed, to demonstrate that you're current again.
Yeah.
Or still,
yeah.
you know. So I just said that I would let you guys kick this issue around again, just to maybe clarify amongst yourselves and on the record that we don't need dates on our seals.
I still stand by my original stance that I don't think we need them on there. I think it causes more consternation. And quite honestly, it's confusing. I mean, we archived my old electronic seals as we went along, but every now and then one would go out and it would have the old expiration date on it. You know, should I be in trouble for that? I don't think so.
what we're seeing here is bureaucratic overreach with these local agencies. And what they're doing is they're trying to apply our board rules, which is 32 in the board rules that we've adopted in R430. What they're doing is trying to apply those and make those their own and adopt those their own. And we're the authority for licenses and how licenses are applied. It's really overreach by the cities trying to be obstructionist. And I see it here at Mojave County. I see it with our technicians. And they really want to hassle people over something so simple that Ed defined 2 minutes ago as not problematic. But they're using it in that method. So it's really abrasive and destructive for the cities to grab a hold of this and say, we're going to require you to put your date on there. The board regulates seals. And my personal feeling is that that's what the cities need to follow. They shouldn't even ask that question.
You know, Jason, next time I wish you'd really tell us how you really feel.
I agree with you completely. I'm on the other side of the counter from you, Ed, where I receive reviews from people, or I do the reviewing, and I deal with staff here all the time, and they look for any opportunity that they can to say no or to object or to obstruct projects, and I'm tired of it.
I'm with you.
It's just an abuse and an overreach at a sub-professional level. One example in our county is that the registrants of our county that are in the management structure tell their technicians do not ask somebody for their seal the date associated with their seal. It's irrelevant to their submittal, and the technicians do it anyways, and unsuspecting registrants get caught in this little trap where things take time, and the client, the public, is harmed because of the red tape created by these sub-professionals doing these reviews. It just stinks at all levels. So, Ed, you summed it up best, and all your concerns are the same things we see from the other side of the counter. And the registrants, at least in my agency, feel the same way that you do, and we are the management team. So we feel the same way that you do, that the expiration date is not a milk carton item, and it's nothing relevant to the review. If the reviewer wishes to find out if the registrant is current, he can go to the website or call the board, and that's as complicated as that whole matter needs to be.
I'd say
just an observation. I mean, in the regulations, it requires that a registrant sign, seal, and date the document.
Correct.
So that is necessary and sufficient information.
Yeah.
You need no more, because as you said, you can always consult the website to determine if on that date was that seal effective.
Right.
So it would be redundant to put the expiration date next to today's date. Because if the information presumably is verifiable elsewhere.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So.
And the reality is that date is that expiration date is being leveraged against the public to impede their projects. And I don't know what causes that. Goes back to the behavioral health thing I talked about.
Not to mention you'll need a whole new set of plans in the event that the architect dies.
Technicians have that mindset. It must be something inherent in that practice, but they will leverage that to stall a project. Whether that's intentional or not, I don't know, but that's what happens. And the public gets harmed because of this expiration date. So it's really counterproductive in the whole scheme.
I'm just
But I fall back to, we regulate seals, the cities don't. They accept them.
Yep.
Or the local agencies, I should say. And that includes mine. And I go through this question probably on a weekly basis with people. So there's my 2 cents. I hope it helps.
Thanks, Jason. Patty.
Just Melissa, Doug, anybody who's gotten a call, do you think the issue is they don't want to take the time to look at our website? Is it... What are they saying is the problem?
I think it's just we've always done it this way kind of thing, and now we've made a change, and they didn't immediately adjust to it. I mean, we got calls right after the rule went into effect. I haven't gotten any calls in probably the past 3 months.
They have taken it off, but I think it also goes back to what Mr. Marley was talking about earlier. There is this mindset that plans expire, and I don't know how many times I've had to explain that to municipalities and plan reviewers that plans don't expire. Look at the expiration date back when we displayed them. Look at the sign date. If the sign date is before the expiration date, those plans are good. They're good forever.
Yep.
Good newsletter.
Yeah. I actually just got an application for a retaining wall permit from a jurisdiction that requires a wet seal on all copies.
Yep.
It's not going to be a wet seal, folks.
No.
Because
I
think the rubber's drying out on mine. It's still in the drawer, but.
So it sounds like to me that we're good with the rule. We just let the public absorb the newness of it for a while longer.
And let them adjust.
Excellent.
Yep.
Thank you. Okay.
Item E, should the board pursue moving alarm agents, controlling persons, and alarm businesses to DPS?
I'm just happy if you say yes.
I would without hesitation say yes. I guess the question is, what's the tax on our resources to try to get that done?
I don't know. I mean, it would certainly require just a phone call on my part to see if there's somebody over there who might be willing. I mention it periodically to the governor's office. I don't know that they care one way or another. But there are new people at DPS who might be interested. And the alarm industry pays for itself, so it's not like it would be a financial burden on anybody to accept them.
Why DPS?
Because in other states, the equivalent police agency does have the jurisdiction over alarm industries. And we thought about it, Patty and I, early into having to regulate this group. There really are no requirements for registration, like for the professions. Mm-hmm. It's just you pass a fingerprint background check, basically. And DPS is already doing that exact same background check for security guards and private investigators. So, why not do it for alarms?
They're first on the scene when the alarms go off.
Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. So to me, it always seemed like a better fit than when we were up for sunset in 2016 and we still had our lobbyists. The lobbyists and I actually went and met with DPS, and they said no, they didn't want them at the time because they were swamped and overwhelmed with, security guards and private investigators. Mm-hmm. And that was the time, I don't know if you remember, but my nose spontaneously started to bleed right there. It was very dramatic, as my life is these days. But, and it was so hysterical watching 5 police officers scramble around to get me medical attention and tissues and the whole deal. But
you should have stuck while the iron was hot.
It didn't work, right? It didn't work, but they just don't fit here because we regulate professionals. We determine qualifications for registration, and then we investigate whether professionals have violated the standards, the professional practice. We don't really do that with alarms. We register them after they've gotten their fingerprint background, and then we investigate unlicensed people.
Mm-hmm.
DPS has boots to the ground.
Right.
They can respond right away. By the time we respond, the bad guys are...
Right.
I think this is a good idea.
Yeah.
Cool. I tried to explain this to the legislature that what a reactive agency with limited resources,
yeah.
whereas DPS is more of a proactive agency
right.
with way more resources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Patty and her husband were attempted to be scammed by unlicensed alarm people knocking on their doors, you know, what could she do? Call us and say, oh, here's an unlicensed person who is knocking on my door, and we would have to go search for them, when she really could have more effectively called the police and said, there's a scam artist at my front door, I need you to come and arrest him now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do we need a motion to push that away?
If you would like.
Yeah,
but
we can do that. I'll
yeah.
entertain
yeah.
a motion to
Mr.
pursue
Chairman,
this.
I make a motion that we recommend to the board that we move the alarm agents, controlling persons, and alarm businesses to the Department of Public Safety.
Do we have a second?
I'll second that.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Opposed?
Thank you. So we'll
who
make
carries?
Some phone calls. And
thank you.
Let you know.
And I think that concludes it. We've
one more F.
Well, F.
Oh,
F
yes.
is a little ambiguous.
Should a firm designate a principal for each discipline?
This
will take till dinner time.
Hopefully not. Prior boards have said yes, and the current board is saying no. So we thought we'd see what you guys think, because we do get this question periodically, especially as it relates to investigations. You know, so-and-so is an architect, but they're signing off on engineering plans or, you know, geology reports or whatever, and how is that possible? And then the respondent comes back and says, yeah, but our firm does all of that. So I'm the principal architect for the firm, but I hired a geologist who isn't really licensed but is doing the work, and I'm reviewing it, and I'm the responsible person. So the current board has said, okay, but
this kind of goes back to the prior discussion, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you were concerned that an engineer isn't overseeing an engineer, you know, is a non-engineer firm owner kind of overseeing engineering work. Well, this kind of goes to that. Is a geologist overseeing a structural engineer's work, or a structural engineer's overseeing a geologist's work?
But then it opens up a whole can of worms. Like, how many employees are you going to have in your company as principals for all these different disciplines that an architect may have to oversee?
Well, and I think we have to be careful, because if we go by the, follow my train of thought in the last discussion about the definition of principal being
mm-hmm.
a firm owner, my firm could have structural engineers on staff who would develop structural designs for my projects and seal them.
Mm-hmm. And yet not be a principal.
And not be a principal.
That's very common.
It's very
That's
common.
That's very common.
I could have an entire cadre of engineering disciplines in my firm. I could be a sole proprietor and have that
yes.
mm-hmm. and be the principal. I am not going to seal any of their work because I am mm-hmm. not a licensed engineer of any sort. And that would be bad.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we have to segregate between the principal of a firm and the engineer of record. The engineer
yes.
of record is the guy or gal sealing the document, and the principal of the firm is the individual who retains ownership or
and is
you
an
know,
overall responsible
overall
charge
responsible.
Of the work that is produced by that firm. Now, maybe what it means is we need to develop some language somewhere that differentiates between responsible charge registrant and principal registrant.
I think that would be very useful.
We used to call them responsible managing employees or responsible managing officers. I don't know why we don't do that in Arizona, but that's the way we did it back in New York. The responsible managing employee, and that person would carry the registration. And anybody, the same guy owning the Circle K down the street could own the engineering firm. Nobody cared as long as the right people were looking at the drawings and had the proper certifications.
I don't know. It comes up, and where I see it is when firms get registered, you've got maybe an architect who wants to register his firm. He looks at the list of services to be offered. Well, I want to offer engineering, and I want to offer landscape architecture. And we're thinking, well, shouldn't there be somebody in responsible charge for the services being offered by that professional firm?
Well, the answer is yes. Somebody needs to be in responsible charge in the firm for those professional services offered. I think, but not necessarily the principal.
Right. We don't have that definition.
Right.
And that's the big difference.
So we're looking at these firm registrations. Okay, we've got an architect, but look at all these services, and there's no corresponding registrant in responsible charge for these services.
And every discipline should have somebody responsible for it. And it doesn't have to be the principal. I never believed in that.
Well, that has to be, the work has to be sealed, so...
Yeah, but then the architect would be sealing geologist's work. And
No, the geologist would seal.
Well, that shouldn't be the case.
Right.
No, you don't want someone who's not qualified to be sealing work.
Right.
If you're going to do engineering work and mechanical engineering work and landscaping work, all these different people have to be responsible.
I mean, if there's a complaint against an architecture firm for a geological analysis or a geological practice issue, and they didn't have a geologist seal it,
they're in big trouble.
Then they're in trouble.
Right.
Under our current rules.
Right.
So I think there's a way to deal with it, but I agree. I don't think that it makes sense to have require that the firm have a principal in every discipline they list, because they could have people that are licensed in that discipline and that are capable of doing the work and overseeing it and the technical part of it. They just don't own the firm.
Exactly. And I'm agreeing with you.
Okay. So we're good with the current board interpretation, then?
I think it's rational.
Okay.
I think it just may warrant down the road further look at, do we further
define
principal and define responsible charge as it relates to firm, the hierarchy in the firm.
I've been a lawyer for longer than I'd like to admit, and it was tough for me to understand the distinction between principal and responsible charge. I mean, to me, as a lay person looking at this, even as a lawyer who did regulatory work, it was tough for me at the beginning to figure out the distinctions. And it was only after listening to the discussions at the board meeting over time that I figured it out. Imagine what someone with less experience and less industry experience would know, would have a similar issue. So I think we should pursue a better definition or distinctive definition.
Both those terms, principal and responsible in charge. Both those terms deserve.
And not necessarily combine them.
No, they need to be separate and distinct. We need principal, who's someone in an ownership capacity, and then registered and responsible charge that is in a capacity of overseeing the work of people and sealing it, but is not in an ownership position.
Right. It's like the home inspectors redid the parallel inspector and peer review definitions to distinguish them, because they were confusing to lay people as well.
That's right.
You guys, as the experts, understood the distinction, just as you guys understand, but it's the public that maybe doesn't understand,
And that puts me at odds with Mr. Plank in his argument before. I don't believe, his biggest argument was that the guy who stamped these drawings wasn't a principal of the mechanical company, is the way I see it, and I don't feel that he needed to be. That's why I want to be sure that I know when that goes to the board. I want to be in the public. Just watch.
Peter wants to watch.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. So,
all right.
Thank you.
Anything else?
No,
we did it.
Yeah,
we really
appreciate
new business, old business.
The discussion.
Oh, yeah.
So future agenda item.
Just you want to make the motion?
Well, we have future agenda items. I think we've got several on the
right. We're going to carry forward several of the issues we discussed today. Do you want to consider as well reviewing the minimum standards for home inspectors, for surveyors at a future meeting? Or what
Mr.
do you think,
Foose, what do you think?
I would like to. I think we saw today something that even if it wasn't directly related, we see that the technology has advanced far beyond the last publication date of 2001, I think was the minimum standard. So maybe it's time to open that stuff up. So yeah, I'd support or suggest we review the minimum standards.
Okay. And then obviously if you gentlemen can think of other things as time goes on you want to discuss, just let Kurt know and we'll add them. Are you inclined to look at future meeting dates, or do you want to just pend it until we...
It's going to depend on...
Well, we pend it until you have everything gathered, and then you can reach out and set something up. That
right.
way, you know, just get things done in a timely manner. And
right.
Unless you need a deadline. We can always give you
a
deadline.
Yeah, we don't need a deadline just yet. But thank you, Peter. Excellent. Thank you for fleshing out these issues with us, and I'm looking forward to future discussions.
Sounds good.
Mr. Chairman, I make a motion that we adjourn.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Stand adjourned. Thank you all.